Avangs tu pangsa paramashyamayaya. Garancha yas prishta mati samastadrik. Taya hatat masvanuk karma chetaso. Anugraham kartam ihar hasi prabho. And the translation reads, my dear Lord, you are never bewildered by the formidable influence of the illusory energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, you are omniscient and should be merciful and compassionate towards those who are bewildered by the same illusory energy and are very much attached to fruitive activities. He's referring to Daksha in particular. Daksha is one of the sons of Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, one of the sons of Lord Brahma, so the brothers are having a bit of a squabble. Kind of like a lethal squabble. I'll read the purport. Actually, I'll go back. Yeah, I'll read the purport. Short purport. Is never bewildered by the influence of the external energy because he is engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. The Lord states in Bhagavad Gita 7:14, Daivahiyesha gunamayi mamamaya duratyaya mam eva ye prapadyante mayametam tarantite. Translation. My divine energy, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome, but those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. A Vaishnava should take care of those who are bewildered by this maya. Instead of becoming angry with them, because without a Vaishnava's mercy, they have no way to get out of the clutches of maya. Those who have been condemned by maya are rescued by the mercy of devotees. That's the end of the purport. His appeal, the target, the bullseye, the center objective, is to excuse and more to elevate daksha. And daksha, he has some anger problems. Lord Shiva has some anger problems. But Lord Shiva directs them in a transcendental way, and daksha was just simply attached to the bodily conception and fruitive activities, and with that pride and so forth. So he, because of that, he deliberately and explicitly insulted Lord Shiva. The daughter of Daksha, Sati, decided, you're an awful person. The only connection between you and me is this body, and she gave up her body. Right in the assembly, she entered into a fire and poof, she was gone. Daksha came, and the persons responsible for that offense were dealt with. So now the pacifying. So here's, go back two verses. This is on the topic of, it's give forgiveness instead, give elevation. But it's that there's other messages, other transcendental messages, and that is how a transcendentalist should see when others do some things that are untoward or whatever it is, based on the bodily conception of life and their attachments, how to see that circumstance from a transcendentalist perspective. And then from the transcendentalist perspective, to take appropriate action. 47, again, is Lord Brahma speaking. Persons who observe everything with differentiation, duality, who are simply attached to fruitive activities, who are mean-minded, and who are always pained to see the flourishing condition of others, envy goes along with the whole package, and who thus give distress to them by uttering harsh and piercing words, have already been killed by Providence. Thus, there is no need for them to be killed again by an exalted personality like you. And in the purport, Prabhupada explains what it means, what Brahma means by saying they have already been killed. Described that such envious persons are perpetually full of anxieties because they are attached to the material body and are without self-realization. Since their hearts are always filled with anxiety, it is understood that they have already been killed by Providence. The body hasn't been killed, but the purpose has been killed. Just like in the language of Ishopanishad, Atmahana, the killer of the soul, can't kill souls. So what does that mean, the killer of the soul? The real purpose of human existence, the soul in the human form of life, is killed. In a similar concept with Dharma Kaitava. There's a contradiction of terms, in case you didn't notice. Religion is elevating and cheating is not elevating. So that which is given to people in the name of religion, which isn't elevating one to the ultimate purpose, which is loving devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, if it's, for example, platitudes of morality and God's just not in the picture, non-violence and compassion and so forth, where God isn't in the picture, impersonalism and voidism, that's soul killing. What to speak of people who are mean-hearted and spirited and harsh in their speech and so forth. They're already, by providence, by the arrangements of the laws of nature, they're already finished. Mogasha, moga karma, no moga jnana pachetasaha. They're defeated before you even take a step. So, the advocacy of Brahma to Lord Shiva is Vaishnavas therefore should try to revive the Krishna consciousness of others out of compassion for them. That's where the energy should go. If, like Narada, when Narada was offended by Nalakuvira and Manigriva, he contemplated how to elevate these personalities. He didn't think, oh, they've offended me, I'm going to retaliate. I'm going to get back. I would put them in their place and think like that. He was thinking, what will elevate them? What is needed? What is the circumstance that's blocking their higher nature, and instead they're acting according to this very base nature? Why is that? Let's remove that obstacle. What can I do to help remove that obstacle? And he had the power, but he had, you know, the compassionate purpose. He wasn't offended. He saw what their circumstance was, and he took then transcendentally appropriate action, and ultimately they became not only relieved of the problem, but they became perfected devotees. They were delivered by Krishna himself as part of his prophecy, which Krishna then upheld. Then text 48, which is just before this one, Lord Brahma continues, "My dear Lord, if in some places materialists who are already bewildered by the insurmountable illusory energy of the Supreme Lord sometimes commit offenses, a saintly person with compassion does not take this seriously, knowing that they commit offenses because they are overpowered by the illusory energy. He does not show his prowess to counteract them, either the words or actions or the individual soul." And just 2 points to highlight from the purport. Prabhupada says, a tapasvi, this is like, that may not be a devotee, but a tapasvi Vaishnav, certainly, their beauty is forgiveness. Jivadaya, a nice whole long story about Sanatan Goswami coming before Rupa Goswami and asking him. He's his elder brother, and Rupa Goswami looks to him as his spiritual master. And Sanatan Goswami gives him a quiz question. What is the primary outstanding quality of a devotee? And right away, Rupa Goswami says, Jivadaya, compassion upon the living entity. So Sanatana Goswami said, very good. Right answer. Now here's one Jiva Goswami, and you've been angry upon him, so now please show compassion upon him. He's repentant. There was a circumstance where Jiva Goswami soundly defeated a nonsense arguer, debate artist, who came to Vrindavan and wanted to debate Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami had no interest in arguing and debating with a person like that. "Oh, you're too expert. I'm not qualified to debate with you." "Then you signed saying I were defeated." "Yes, yes." So he was then parading around. I defeated Rupa Goswami. Woo woo. So Jiva Goswami ripped him apart. Jiva Goswami's interest was not defeating a debate artist. His interest was defending the honor of Rupa Goswami. So Rupa Goswami wasn't so pleased with that. He said, "You can leave Vrindavan, because Vrindavan is not a fit place for someone who has some pride and the wish to defeat people." But it wasn't a wish to defeat people. And certainly Rupa Goswami knew that, you know, the heart of Jiva Goswami. In any case, he sent him away. Sanatana Goswami brought him back something like a year later. So, compassion, but transcendental compassion. And the emphasis in this morning is going to be on the transcendental part, because we're an assembly of devotees, so we don't have to make things soft. With public audiences, we may make it a little soft. But it's transcendental compassion. Because the transcendental compassion of Narada was, he cursed them to become trees. The transcendental compassion of Rupa Goswami was, you leave Vrindavan. Now we can't imitate such persons. We should not imitate such persons. I'll be transcendentally compassionate to you, Prabhu. We don't have that qualification. But transcend whatever the interactions we have with others, emphasis upon transcendental. That is, that, you know, so we're going to discuss that a bit. Transcendental conception of others. A Vaishnava should take care of those who are bewildered by this maya instead of becoming angry with them, because without a Vaishnava's mercy, they have no way to get out of the clutches of maya and condemned by the mercy of devotees. That's our verse for this morning. And here's our theme that at least I hope I'll be able to convey. The overall theme of the retreat is acceptance and progress. So a lot of discussion has been acceptance of one's own position. Now this is focusing on acceptance of the position of others, because we're social beings, naturally so. In the spiritual world, there's varieties of living entities, all engage very harmoniously and happily and joyfully in Krishna service. We're not alone. We have our social needs as social beings. We have social propensities. And if we want to be accepting, we need to be accepting, starting with ourselves and in our social interactions, accepting of others. And then it's possible to have a genuine relationship. So a big part of this, just to say it again, is understanding our own nature and being accepting of our own nature. Now, in accepting of others, along with self-honesty, a companion quality for healthy relationships is the tandem presence of a similar honesty in recognizing the diverse features of others and acceptance of those features. When honoring one another's material differences, one may then consciously choose to move forward within a relationship with integrity, meaning not just cosmetically but genuinely and substantially. A spiritual concept of both myself and the other individual are equally essential. This is this morning's message. So to help illustrate it, a couple more verses. This is a verse from Bhagavad Gita. Sixth chapter is Dhyana Yoga, where he is a perfect yogi who, by comparison to his own self, sees the true equality of all beings in both their happiness and distress, O Arjuna! Exclamation point. So there's seeing of diversity. This case is being pointed to happiness and distress. But so go back, and first there's one's own happiness and distress. The transcendentalist becomes indifferent to that happiness and distress. Let's just say the same dualities that Krishna speaks of in Bhagavad Gita, heat and cold, pleasure, pain. And then a more subtle one, honor, dishonor. It's duality, that's all. And duality that arises from what? From contact of the senses with sense objects and the mood of enjoying. That's where it arises from. So within the mind, there's a processor that says, oh, this is happiness. And another person says, no, that's distress. People that are used to really hot weather, and they come to the West where it's summer, and it's like they've all bundled up and got a hat on, and whoo, you know, aren't you? No, I'm used to it's hot, and this is over here, this is cold. What to speak of winter? Anyway, to one person, something is this, it's happiness, and another person is distress. Same thing. And it's subjective. That's the material differences. Then there's the spiritual conception of the individual. And understanding both it requires a degree of self-realization. Here's from the purport. One who is Krishna conscious is aware of everyone's happiness and distress by dint of his own personal experience. The cause of the distress of a living entity is forgetfulness of his relationship with God. And the cause of happiness is knowing Krishna. And he gives 529 Bhagavad Gita, you know, the example of knowing Krishna. The perfect yogi knows that the living being who is conditioned by the modes of material nature is subjected to the threefold material miseries due to, same thing, forgetfulness of his relationship with Krishna. So that's the happiness-distress element. And for that matter, the happiness is, material happiness is also distress when that material happiness, the adjective material, is appropriate when one forgets Krishna. So one is in a good fortune or ill fortune position. Those of you who were here the first evening, the Chinese farmer story. Good fortune, ill fortune, who can say? So, a transcendentalist understands the good fortune is illusory, the ill fortune is illusory, and they have another perspective, or they have another shelter, and that's transcendental relationship with Krishna. So out there is duality, and it's not good or bad. It's not ill fortune, good fortune, happiness. It's a temporary configuration, the material energy that really, as far as the soul is concerned, is irrelevant. It's an opportunity to serve in this way or that way. That way it's relevant, but it's not determining my happiness or my distress or my sense of contentment or displeasure. That's a transcendentalist. They can see distinctions, but they're not identifying with them on the material platform. They can see them, but they're accepting. So this is the configuration of duality for today. Hari Bol. Can you move the projector a little bit to the left so we get the words? There we go. Okay. So this is another section, also from the fourth canto, where Lord Vishnu has come to speak to an incarnation of Lord Vishnu, Prithu. And the situation is Indra got the heebie-jeebies again. He started thinking, uh-oh, Prithu wants my position. He's trying to do 100 Ashwamedha Yajnas, and so I got to stop that 100th Ashwamedha Yajna. So he came and kidnapped the horse, and he did all kinds of stupid things. And Indra came to speak to Prithu and said, you don't need to do the 100th. And Indra's got the heebie-jeebies, so just like, you know, let it go. Recognize his need, or at least what he thinks is his need, and his worry and all of that. Just don't involve yourself with, and be respectful of, the situation that Indra has over there. He's my devotee too. And, you know, I'll work with him on him with the EBGB problem. And you're a transcendentalist. So just shanti. Shanti means peace for those of you that are. Be peaceful. Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, said, "My dear King Pritu, Indra, the King of Heaven, has disturbed your execution of 100 sacrifices. Now he has come with me to be forgiven by you. Therefore, excuse him. Forgiveness. O King, one who is advanced in intelligence," that's Pritu, "and eager to perform welfare activities for others," that's Pritu, or supposed to be us, Vaishnavas, "is considered best amongst human beings. An advanced human being is never malicious to others, even if others have been malicious towards them. Amanina manadina. Those with advanced intelligence are always conscious that this material body is different from the soul. That's the platform, the ground, the foundation for transcendental perception, and then in turns, transcendental conduct, and to act as a transcendentalist. Spiritual conception must be there. If a personality like you were so much advanced because of executing the instructions of the previous acharyas, is carried away by the influence of my material energy, then all your advancement may be considered simply a waste of time." Nobody wants that. Come to the transcendental position. "Those who are in full knowledge of the bodily conception of life, who know that this body is composed of nescience desires and activities resulting from illusion, does not become addicted to the body." And then finally, "How can a highly learned person who has absolutely no affinity for the bodily conception of life be affected by the bodily conception in regard to house, children, wealth, and similar other bodily productions? Now this is this last sentence is relevant to, you know, aham mameti. Aham means the conception of self, who I think I am, and mama means from who I think I am, what is mine. I and mine. And that I and mine consciousness, that's the name of the game. It's the material existence. Through false ego, adopting a misconception of who we are, and then on the basis of that misconception of who we are, mine. And the program is, make more things mine. Acquisition of property and possession and, you know, gross and subtle. Honor, distinction, position, recognition, and all of that. I and mind, and we build our little kingdom. Ravindrasrupa Prabhu calls it our God project. Then at the end of life, it's all dissolved. Just like a child may go to the beach and the tide is out and they build a sandcastle and the tide comes in and there goes the sandcastle. It just gets dissolved in the seawater. And such is our God project. We're born, we can say, as it's commonly said, innocent. Of course, we're carrying with us a whole bunch of baggage of our karma and our material desires. But we were born innocent, and then we do our God project, and then it's all dissolved. And that's life, material life. And in between defending and protecting and arguing and controlling and liking and disliking and happiness and distressing, and then we're gone. And the transcendentalist understands that's illusory existence. And so there should be, it's substitute, or the real thing is transcendental existence, including, now back to the theme, our social needs. Because in the transcendental world, we're also a social being, because it's just intrinsic. We have a relationship with Krishna. We also have a relationship with Krishna's part and parcel living entities. Here's a real simple multiple choice question. When you go back to the spiritual world, A, it's just going to be you and Krishna. B, there's Krishna and unlimited numbers of loving living entities engaged in loving relationship with Krishna surrounding his lotus feet, and you're one of them. Real easy. So if that's the picture, then how do we practice that here? My dear devotees, if you don't have a spiritual conception, you won't. At best, as Prabhupada describes in Sri Isha Upanishad, the concept of universal brotherhood is hollow. It rings, oh, isn't that inspiring? But without the spiritual conception, that's just the beginning. It's not possible. And spiritual conception package is, there's the soul in relation to the Supreme Soul. Confidential knowledge, more confidential knowledge, most confidential knowledge. There is an intimate loving relationship between the soul and the Supreme. And guess what? Others also have. And guess what? It's very diverse. Very colorful. Fantastic. But here in this plane, the diversity is a perverted reflection of that diversity, and I got my favorite ones and I got my ones I don't like. So when you look at this image, what do you see? Okay, it's a nice flower vase with some flowers in it. And the flower vase is blue. And there's some blue flowers, yellow flowers, red flowers, pink flowers, different kinds of flowers, some greens. There's like some diversity over there on top of a table. So Prabhupada used this as a metaphor to describe unity within diversity, within society. So with an Irishman, Mr. O'Grady, and some of you may not know your world history about Ireland, but I'll clue you in case you don't. There's a big, long-standing, heavy-duty, years and years and years and years and years and years of war between North Ireland and South Ireland. And it has to do with religion, of all things. Catholics and Protestants. And they bloody war of fellow countrymen over a Protestant and Catholic perspective of what Christ wanted. So, Mr. O'Grady is from Ireland. You can tell by his name. O'Grady is an Irish name. So Prabhupada is saying, materialistic society means duality, Mr. O'Grady. But that is unavoidable. How can you avoid material existence? Prabhupada. That is possible in Krishna consciousness. The lotus lives in the water, but never touches the water. Mr. O'Grady isn't convinced. I don't think you can explain situations in one area with metaphors from another. Like, you know, lotuses and water and the conflicts between people. How can you argue political problems in terms of vague spiritual concepts? Their nature is completely different. No, the whitewash of spiritual platitude isn't going to take care of. There's differences out there, and people can have issues with differences, and therefore you have party spirit and politics and religions and, you know, people in different groups that are at odds with each other, and sometimes it gets violent. Sometimes it's like Cold War and sometimes it's hot war. So now Prabhupada gives the following response. He gestures to the vase that's on the table and he says, sometimes the variety of examples helps us to understand or appreciate the problem better. In the vase, there is a variety of flowers, and that variety helps us better appreciate the idea of flowers, because after all, flowers are variegated. And appreciating the variegatedness of the variety of flowers helps us understand the essence of flower. He doesn't put it, the idea of flowers. From any point of view, Krishna can resolve all problems. All problems. That is called unity in diversity. Our students come from different backgrounds. But because they are all in Krishna consciousness, they are unified. And the converse is, if we're not Krishna conscious, we won't be unified. And we won't see unity. We'll see differences, and then I like this kind of difference, I don't like that kind of difference, so I'm going to group myself with this kind because I like this kind, I don't like that kind, we're going to be clashing with that kind of diversity, rather than Krishna conscious. So the solution, Prabhupada is pointing to Mr. O'Grady, and I'm trying to convey this morning, is the foundation of it is Krishna conscious. So that's like a big term, Krishna conscious. What is that? Krishna is at the center. All diversity, just as in the spiritual world, all diversity, there's diversity in the spiritual world. It's not homogeneous smoothie. There's lots of diversity, unlimited diversity in the spiritual world. But there's complete harmony because Krishna is at the center, and love of Krishna rules the hearts of all that diversity. So they live in harmony with one another based upon their love for Krishna. And even when there's differences and there's like appearance of like left-wing gopis and right-wing gopis, for example, it's simply to enhance the love for Krishna, the happiness of Krishna. It's not like, not the material kind. The material kind is minus Krishna. And the spiritual kind is for the pleasure of Krishna, centered upon Krishna, in harmony with Krishna's pleasure. That's all. So that spirit, when that spirit of Krishna consciousness, Krishna's pleasure is everything, and then we find ourselves where there's spiritual variegatedness, and now I'm more especially speaking about in this morning's class, about material variegatedness. So it starts with self-honesty and self-acknowledgement and self-acceptance. Without that, in a spiritual and a material paradigm, meaning we have our uniquenesses materially as well as in spiritual individuals, and be accepting of that reality and move toward Krishna within that reality. Then there's others who are similar in their journey to Krishna. They have their uniquenesses and specialities. And like going back to these other fourth canto references, where there may be attachment to fruitive activities and the bodily conception of life and so forth and so on. You know, that the not nice kind of material differences due to previous activity. There they are in that soup of struggling with material energy. So rather than dislike that person or judge the person or harsh words, you know, do anything towards that, you recognize the situation and, like Narada, be in the mood of service towards them, or Prahlad Maharaj, or Haridas Thakur, or our great acharyas. You can't imitate. Prabhupada in these purports gives the example of Jesus Christ twice. Although they were harsh towards him, he wasn't harsh towards them. And he was interested in their elevation, as was Prahlad towards Hiranyakashipu, and so forth. I want to go now to embellish this or expand it to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the spiritual master of our founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada. And two references. The first one is from the very first edition of an English publication called The Harmonist, June 1927. That's quite some time ago, but the same principle holds nearly 90 years later. Harmony is possible only when one has obtained a firm footing in the dharma, or the function of the soul. This is the trend. In our interactions with others. So there's the bigger picture of like community and Vaishnav Sangha, and you know, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, you know, the real big picture. But then there's our, you know, the smaller circle of our lives and who we interact with. Just take that picture for the moment. Harmony in relationships will not manifest without, according to Bhaktisiddhanta, having obtained a firm footing. Not like casual or cerebral or in the mind only. Mentally embracing, oh, it's nice. But a firm footing, like founded in Sambandhagyan, transcendental knowledge, in the dharma or the function of the soul. Not just a concept, but the activity of the soul, the duties of the soul who's, again, both recognizing material differences or the uniquenesses of my situation and my spiritual elevation position in an honest, self-appraising way and with the consultation of other wise persons. And I'm acting from that footing soundly. Now I'm interacting with others. The interacting with others can be harmonious if and only if that first one is established. So now I'm going to go to another reference from Bhaktisiddhanta, and this is taken from Brahma Samhita text 61, where he is describing, Krishna is describing to Lord Brahma about how to, you know, this one of these favorite words of people practicing Krishna consciousness, how do I balance my worldly and my devotional life. You know that one. So basically, Krishna says, take the word balance out. Just, it's center your worldly on Krishna. And then it's, then you got to balance. It's because it's not this versus that, it's this. So he writes, mankind live, one could say maybe lives, but he put live, mankind live by the threefold activities of body, mind, and society. Note that that's not the soul. It's the covering of the soul. We have our needs, social needs, bodily needs, mental needs. We have our needs. And he lists like, you know, long thing, a list of them. For example, da-da-da-da-da-da. When these activities are managed to be performed in a way that is conducive to our endeavor for attainment of bhakti, they are called guna bhakta, should be bhakti yoga. There's an old version, it's now been, I think, corrected, because later in the verse it's, in this section, renderings is jnana bhakti yoga, which doesn't exist, but guna means subsidiary. Gona Bhakti Dharma or Gona Dharma, the subsidiary devotional practices, but only those activities that are characterized by the principle of pure worship are called Bhakti proper. So it's Krishna speaking to Brahma, my meditation. This is how you should understand, Brahma, the dilemma that you have. You want to be the creator, but at the same time you want to be a transcendentalist. You want to be involved in the world with things of this world. At the same time, you want to maintain your transcendental position, balance. My meditation is practiced in every act. When bhakti proper is practiced in due time, while performing the subsidiary devotional activities in one's intercourse with the ungodly people of this world, in such position, a jiva does not become apathetic to Godhead even by performing those worldly activities. So it's bona fide, you can go to the office and do your job. And you can go to school and do your studies along with people that are, you know, they have some nonsense things going on in their lives. You're not rendered unwholesome by that contact. Provided two things. At the center is Krishna and Krishna Bhakti, and these other things, these three body, mind, word things, and, you know, social things, are subsidiary functions, because I have a body, and you'll see from the list, it's just things that you do, things that people do. The things that the mind does, things that our social needs require. So we're social beings, we want relationships. But sometimes relationships can get a little prickly, and you know, you get close to somebody and, you know, some sandpaper starts to rub, and like, wait a minute, I'm gonna back off, and maybe I was better off not having any friends. But I want friends, and what do I do? Those are subsidiary functions that, when joined with bhakti proper, they take their place. And so this is the place is, I just as I accept that I have my uniqueness, that flower over there has a different uniqueness. A different color, and a different fragrance, and a different species even, and, you know, there's differences in flowers, and put them all in a vase and it looks nice. You bring the Sangha of devotees together, my goodness, it's fantastic. Such diversity. I'm sure some of you have thought about this. I've thought about it. Often. Who would come together with the people who we've come together with if it wasn't for Krishna consciousness? Like in our temples, we have like, what, such an interesting group of people that live in our temples. If we went out and decided, I want to associate with these people, we wouldn't pick those people. But there we are, living in a temple and with these people. Or just a recent experience was we had an international leadership sangha in Mayapur. It was the second one. And there were 1,000 devotees from all around the world. And so instead of just like the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, just say it, there it was. There was this color and there was that color and there was this language and that language and this culture and that culture and this way of looking and that way of looking, and my goodness, what a flower vase. And we all came together. And it was, supposing we don't come together, supposing we just like go off and be, you know, our flower type. That's nice. And it's like, I sat down with, cause we were encouraged, the GBC members were encouraged, don't just sit, go and find people you don't know and sit with the people you don't know. Just like at the very first day, I encouraged, besides being with your friends and getting an opportunity to be with your friends, go find some people you don't know and say, Hari Bol, Prabhu, and get to know them, because you'll find, they're nice. And then they'll feel encouraged because maybe they're new here or something like that. So I did that a lot, and it was nice. So one of the ones, I sat at a table. We had prasadam in a hall that was like huge. I don't know, fit 1,000 people in the hall at tables. It was like a big hall. So there were a group of devotees there from Africa. So I went and may I sit with you? He said, oh, come on, sit down. Sure, thanks. So I said, do you all know each other? And they smiled. They looked at each other and said, well, yeah. I said, where are you from? And you're all from a different country. So how do you know each other? So we get together. We have these regional festivals. And because we have regional festivals, when we come together, we get to know each other. And now we're like best of friends, although we go back to our different countries and do our service because we're leaders in different countries. But now we have friendships, although we're from different countries. Well, that's fantastic. Then I started asking, some questions like, what's it like? Do you find the people in Africa, they really like the music, and so that's like how you bring people into Krishna consciousness, because, the music. Bibi Govinda Maharaj was describing his experience in South Africa. Some of you were from Chicago, you heard this one. If you don't know Bibi Govinda Maharaj, it won't mean the same to you, but he was describing, it was a stage where there were 3,500 people seated and another 1,000 standing, with a 65-piece orchestra behind him to support, he likes the saxophone, but he had 65-piece orchestra supporting him. And over there was a Christian choir of African ladies who had angelic voices, like he said, like Aretha Franklin and this one or that one, and like really good voices. He was, wow. And then in the audience, they were dancing and dancing and dancing in all different nationalities and groups of people that previously would never even be in the same place together, were just swept away by the holy name. And then he brought, the lead of the 20 ladies to come, and he said that when they started singing, they didn't just sing, they were dancing. Just part of the culture. They were on stage dancing, and the people out in the audience started dancing with the ladies that were dancing on stage, and everyone was just like in this uproar of activity according to one's nature, but connecting with transcendence. That's the message. So I asked these men at the table, did people just like the kirtan, or what is it that seems to appeal to them the most. You know, special prasadam, but something that I've learned over time is people have certain tastes. The West Indian people like West Indian food. You give them something that others like and they don't like it. You give something they like and the others may not like it. Anyway, without in the Chinese, their Chinese food, it takes time to get an acquired taste. And so they generally, when they have visiting, they call the overseas devotees come to China. They serve what they're used to, that, you know, only the Chinese food. Anyway, we have different habits, and so part of the accept having a genuine relationship is to accept. There's differences. It's fantastic. Not like I like this one, I don't like, not judging, but it's fantastic. There's diversity out there. That's on the material platform. And appreciating and staying in the mood of appreciation is dependent upon the spiritual conception of that's beneath that diversity. What to speak of then going into the spiritual diversity. That's, you know, Krishna Consciousness 201. This is 101. Just appreciating the diversity amongst the different people and connecting those subsidiary activities in connection with, joined with, bhakti proper. And then we have respect for diversity while not abandoning respect for our own uniqueness. So I have these images, the unity and diversity images. I tried to find some, and some seem to be nice. And last is Prabhupada's, an appeal that Prabhupada made on more than one occasion, but there's a very famous letter to Kurandar in 1971 where he appealed, please try to maintain the philosophy of unity and diversity that will make our movement successful. That's like, you know, the big picture. And then, you know, go to the smaller picture. It's, you know, those with whom you associate. Like, you know, the people that are around you that you may not know because they're from some other place or some other place or some other culture or some other whatever. And then, you know, but we're all part Krishna consciousness, or even again the smaller unit of people in your community where you do regularly associate, and let the same principle not degenerate into familiarity breeds contempt, but respecting the differences, just like where there's the closest of relationships in a family, there's differences. You know, people that are friends, that's nice. And when they live together, it's a whole other thing. Like, you know, live in an ashram for a while. Live in a Hare Krishna ashram for a while. You'll see, my goodness, it's like being a friend with somebody is one thing, but living with that person in that ashram is another something. It's like getting married. And those of you that are married, you know what that's like. You can like her and she likes him, but you live together and, whoa, wait a minute, it's a whole other story. Yes? So if you have to maintain that respect so it doesn't degenerate into, I know too much about your weaknesses and your shortcomings, and so now I'm just fault-finding with you because I don't like this shortcoming and that shortcoming, and, well, what to speak of yours, and then you have, you know, a broken relationship. Because it wasn't based on something transcendental, nor accepting of another person's. And perhaps it's even go before that. It's just not, I'm not even self-honest about my own shortcomings in my position and the need for me to be properly situated. So I'm working through the process of elevation in a prescribed manner under someone's direction, just kind of off on my own, thinking, I know what's right, just ask me. It's 1973. Prabhupada took Kurandar. So, final. A symptom of properly hearing the holy name and Krishna Katha, Prabhupada's statement, is that we become free from the propensity to criticize others and sectarianism. So we have this wonderful foundational activity of Sankirtan, congregationally coming together and chanting the holy name and purifying. And on that same basis, as in the Kirtan, which Prabhupada said is the safest place to be, is in Kirtan, then we have our other social activities, which from the strength of doing this properly, we can do that properly. At least the opportunity is made, the door is opened. Hare Krishna. Any discussion? Jai Jagannath. Where's the microphone? You just speak up and...
And also Lord Brahma speaking to Lord Shiva, saying that because your intelligence is not influenced by the powerful modes of nature, you're able to see with equal vision, all you can see the spirit soul and not become bewildered by their behaviors. And so I guess my question comes up when speaking to an audience like us or otherwise, what does it mean to have firm footing in Krishna consciousness? Because I oftentimes feel that we consider like social platitudes to be tantamount to firm footing in Krishna consciousness. So if we can be nice to each other and respectful, and we give each other hugs and kisses and support, that is considered to be tantamount to actual firm footing in Krishna consciousness. So I was wanting to know, how do we really recognize that we actually have really firm ground? Because you were making the point also about the tendency to accept Krishna consciousness in the mind. And so how do we know we're not just being deceived by social platitudes and we actually have a firm standing in Krishna consciousness by which harmony could actually be realized?
Well, two short answers to a nice question that could take a long time to give a full answer. One is Sambandh Gyan. For those who are newer, it means firm foundation in understanding what's what. That is, all things in relation to Krishna. And it's not, as Prabhupada writes in Bhagavad Gita 2:41, beyond even the possibility of deviating from that position, the spiritual conception of all things in relation to Krishna. So not just theoretical, but deeply rooted, beyond theoretical, deeply rooted, then a kind of litmus test of that, this is part two, is ahaitukiya pratyata. That is to say, there is not something that causes that position, there's not a material circumstance that's pre-required, nor is there a material circumstance that can change it. It's truly spiritual. Two examples of that that come to mind. One is Srinathji. He's interviewed in Your Ever Well Wisher, Srila Prabhupada biography, and he's like a super industrialist, like a mega wealthy man in India. Mr. Desai. So when he met Prabhupada, he confessed, being a businessman, the nature of a businessman is they want to see the weakness of the other person. It's Swamiji. To see where is his weakness. And he had no weakness. You know, tempted with money, and tempted with pride, and tempted with this, and tempted with that, and there was no weakness. Then I can understand, firmly situated in the Dharma of the soul. in the practical functioning of the soul. He was acting from that position unconditionally. And there's another example, just recent. So, when Hiranyakashipu wanted to destroy Prahlad, one of the ways he tried to kill Prahlad was he pushed him off a cliff. Or he had his guys push him off a cliff, his henchmen, his gundas. So, up on a cliff, pushed him off the cliff, and Prahlad is falling. So, our acharyas describe, as Prahlad was falling, Lord Vishnu wanted to examine him. Is he really dependent upon me? So he didn't catch him right away. He's falling and falling and falling and falling and falling, and Prahlad didn't. Wait a minute, where's Vishnu? He was fully confident. At the last minute, he caught him. No material cause that brings about this position, nor material circumstance that can check that position. That's a test, where it's firm footing. And of course, then there's degrees of approaching that. But everyone has their button, their breaking point, their shortcoming, where something, and you know, then it comes that, well, they were, you get a 9 but not a 10 or something like that. Or it's simply pretense. It's simply pretense. I'll give another example. As a new devotee, I grew up in a little tiny town that I wouldn't even tell you the name of it because you'd laugh. It's so, like, so small. And then, you know, I went to college and met the devotees and became a devotee and joined the Boston Temple. And to make a long story short, I was a trade. The Boston Temple needed somebody that can run a printing press, and there was somebody in New York that knew how to run a printing press, so that devotee went from New York to Boston, and I was a trade. I went back to New York. And, you know, I never had even looked at New York on a map, what to speak of thought of living in a big city like New York, and there I was living in New York. It was the end of the summer and the fall season, and it's funny, you know. The first day we went out in Harinam, and it was in front of the library, 42nd Street Library in Fifth Avenue, and then the kirtan party, you know, dancing, and you know, and then the sankirtan leader of that particular party was a devotee named Kirti Raj, called a disciple. Really tall, Polish devotee, grew up in New Jersey, you know, kind of like, you know, rough and tumble. So he approached somebody that asked them to take a magazine. And the man said, ah. And Kirti Raj said, come on. And the guy said, what is it? It's a book about God. Take a look. And show them the pages. And all right, here's some money. And he left. And I said, oh my God, this is New York. Oh boy. And then it was the chief season came, and in anticipation of the winter season, I was asked to go buy winter garments for the devotees. Hooded sweatshirts, long underwear, and, you know, gloves and stuff, and woolen socks. So they sent me to the garment district. That's like going to the bowels of New York City. And this little guy, like, oh my God. And it's not retail stores, it's wholesale places where it's like rough and tumble, and who knows, you know, what street fight's going to happen out there as you're going along. So I went from place to place, and this little guy wearing my dhoti, and you know, asking people, "What's your price on hooded sweatshirts?" And I went to one place, and you know, the man, the owner, had this little tiny shop with like 10,000 things in a space that was meant for three things, and he just looked at me and said, "Oh,
come with me.
Okay. And he took me into the back room and he showed me on the wall where he had photos of himself going to South America when he goes, because here in the winter it's summer down there, so he would go there in the winter and in the summer down there, and he would feed people. He showed pictures of himself feeding people. You know, lots of people. Different pictures. See, that's me, and there's the people I'm feeding. So I'm this, you know, little brahmachari that learned some things from the Bhagavad Gita class and said, well, that's really nice, but can you tell me what you're doing for the soul? And the guy turned into an animal. You have no respect. You have no appreciation. Get out of here at once. What kind of spiritual religious person are you? Get out, get out, get out. And then I realized, you know, he wanted something for that service he was doing. It wasn't, you know, there's a happiness of doing it, but he also wanted something. Some respect and some appreciation, and that was his button. So there's platitudes of, you know, social demeanor and, you know, but really what's behind it all? And if what's really behind it all isn't behind it all, then it's cosmetic at best. But people that don't know what's behind it all, what's out there? So that's what he's doing is wonderful. And what he's doing is wonderful. And may it lead to, you know, transcendental, through association with transcendentalists. Does that help? Yeah, go ahead further.
You were mentioning at this point our strength in sambandha again. And oftentimes we feel ourselves very satisfied with a just understanding.
Theoretical.
Oh, okay, I'm the soul, Krishna's God, I'm the servant.
No problem.
And I've understood.
I don't have any objection to it. It's very fine with me.
Yes. And then
reality hits.
And then I feel that some devotees may even be successful and able to adjust their mental states when they're disturbed and so on. But my question is, how deep should our sambandhagyan go? And the reason I'm asking this is because I obviously have a personal appreciation for reading shastras and technical stuff and so on. And all devotees may not share that appreciation. So I oftentimes hear a strong emphasis on, you know, the essence of sambandhagyan is just service. And they'll quote the example, which I've never really appreciated, but they'll quote the example of the South Indian Brahmana. What knowledge did he have? He just saw a picture of Krishna, and he began crying, and he didn't have any knowledge, and that's bhakti. And I'm like, yeah, that's bhav bhakti, prema bhakti, but we're on the sadhana bhakti platform, and what do we require for actually getting to that level? So my question is, how deep should that someone again be? How much emphasis should we give to our study and these sorts of aspects?
Let me respond to your question in a way that may not be satisfying, but the emphasis that I would like to make is diversity, meaning that South Indian Brahmin and Jai Jagannath and somebody else and somebody else, you know, the whole bouquet there, there's diversity of how they are particularly inspired to approach that position. And as you have a particular approach, fine. And others that have a different approach, fine. You know, as others should respect your approach, you respect others' approach. And others' approach may be diverse. And they may get to the same place that you're getting to by the way that you like. They may read less and serve more. And their heart may be as soft as yours, with, you know, simple realization. They may not be on the Bhava Bhakti platform, they're on the Sadhana Bhakti platform. But their approach is different, and that's fantastic. You shouldn't be judged as, you know, you're a nerd or something, you like to read too much. And they shouldn't be judged, you're a workaholic, there's what's wrong with you, you don't read enough. Respect the differences of... Now, some element certainly must be there of reading, and some element must be there of service. And some different flowers of different varieties. The nourishment must be there. Kirtan, and reading, hearing, and practical service. It's not that reading, hearing isn't practical service, but you know, it's a, some have this penchant and some have that penchant, and that's fine. Respect the uniqueness, provided the essential elements are there. Yes. The conch is going to blow, if this may be our last question.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. By seeing the Rupa Goswami's and Jiva Goswami's incident, and also it has been mentioned that Vaishnava has to be like a tolerant, like a blade of the grass for themselves. And
humble like a blade of grass,
yeah.
Tolerant like a tree. Go ahead.
And but we should not tolerate if any Vaishnava or Lord is getting insulted. So Jiva Goswami, he did his duty.
Properly.
Yeah. And but still he got the...
He got some mercy. That's the freedom of the guru-disciple relationship. From an outsider position, Jiva Goswami didn't do anything wrong. There was a purpose of his spiritual master, Rupa Goswami, and the purpose was served. And you know, we don't take sides on this kind of thing. We respect Rupa Goswami, we respect Jiva Goswami. And they've got this wonderful relationship going on that, fantastic. Now, just on this note, there are critics of Jiva Goswami that go, just see. He had this big anartha. There are, you know, scholars that write like that. I'm a scholar, and I get to say anything about anybody because I'm a scholar. Anyway, there's transcendental essences in relationships, and that's fantastic. Okay, we're going to end because the conch is going to... Somebody has a burning question you want to ask? Right up front. Up here. Quickly. Same quickly.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. In my training in Krishna consciousness, I've always been trained to be loyal to Srila Prabhupada and his followers in ISKCON. Recently, I had a conversation with a devotee who was mentioning that this diversity principle should be used towards devotees outside as well, even those that have left ISKCON and become spiritual masters. And even though the GBC is trying to protect us from them, we should not see it in the eye of making that distinction, rather see them as one of the flowers in the vase of Vaishnavism.
Well, you know, this is not a short question. We have our founder Acharya, and we are obliged, in love and obliged both, to understand as deeply as our capacity allows us to understand what he did, what he said about what he did, and what he wanted for us. In ISKCON, that is our obligation. Now, somebody else may answer this question, respond in a different way. I'm going to respond in my way. So, contemplating that very seriously, especially through the assistance of those who intimately associated with Prabhupada. Like, you know, we're over here, and then there's some over there, and there's some over there, but there's some that very fortunately had intimate association, like Hari Sori and others, intimately associated with the Prabhupada, how he wanted this to be addressed. And how we wanted this to be addressed was, we offer respect, but we don't invite into our assembly and, you know, go and, you know, there's details of history, persons, you know, gets colorful. But principle is, the main person who we hear from is our founder Acharya, And if there are persons whose words are different from his words, we don't go there. And it was, I mean, I was a new devotee. This is just, you know, a minute and a half. We were told, maybe Prithu Shrava remembers this, we were told, don't read Sri Brahma Samhita. Okay, so we didn't read Sri Brahma Samhita or any of the literature that came from that moth down the street. Because that moth down the street had an issue with Bhaktisiddhanta, and they edited on a principle of Bhaktisiddhanta made a boo-boo, and so they edited Sri Brahma Samhita. And then there's the version that ISKCON published Sri Brahma Samhita, where it didn't have that edited thing. Because there was like criticism of Bhaktisiddhanta by a certain person who did the editing work and then published something else. He told us not to read it. So when the contradiction of the Acharya takes place, our founder Acharya, we can respect from a distance but not mix with that person. And then it gets into subtleties. But that's the position. We respect from a distance. It can be, you know, a flower vase over there. By someone's own choosing, they've got their own entity and their own, you know, something-something, which is different than what Prabhupada said to do, and so, okay. We respect them from a distance. We don't intend to be mixed with them. And there's details and subtleties and so forth, but there's an essence. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.